This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and thank you for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElrath. And we're going to start off this podcast in the Isle of Man, on the top of its highest point, Snaefell.
2,000 feet up on the Isle of Man. We've had a brilliant wee tram journey up to get here. Here we are, right at the centre of what's going to be a great journey.
The whole point of coming up here to stand in the teeth of a howling gale was to try and get the views, because theoretically you can see Seven Kingdoms from this spot, but to be frank, the cloud came down about 5 minutes ago and it's not looking good.
It's all gone, but when we were here, we could see Scotland, we could see Ireland, we could see Wales, we could see England, the Isle of Man obviously, but I'm not... What was the other two?
The other two was the Kingdom of Neptune and the Kingdom of God, if you looked up.
Clever.
I'm not sure I could look up in this wind.
Can I? Yeah, I'm blowing horizontal at the moment, but honestly, as we were coming up the hill, we could see the summit perfectly. The minute we started climbing that last bit of the summit, woof, the cloud came in, and equally, as I speak, it's disappearing
again. It's like a dance of the seven veils. The Isle of Man is not big. I mean, it's 34, 35 miles long from stem to stern, but the amount of variety is astonishing. Our time here in the Isle of Man has been characterised by transport in a whole variety of new and exciting and different ways. We're on the Mountain Railway now, which is an electric tram which runs up, at times, a 1 in 12 incline up Snaefell, which I've no idea how it works. Andrew Scarfe works with local transport organisation for the Isle of Man. What's the history of this? How far back does it go?
The history of the railway itself goes right back to 1895. For a start, really, the tourism boom, I should say, in the island. Hundreds of thousands of people coming over to the Isle of Man each year, and it was just built as a solely as a tourist attraction to get people up to the top of the mountain to see where they've come from.
It's a bit of a leap of faith, though, because would they have known that it was going to work?
To be honest, at the time, no. It was not known in 1895 whether actually electric trams would go up a gradient of 1 in 12 by wheel adhesion, and that wheel adhesion is the grip between the metal wheel and the metal rail. And obviously, the steeper the gradient, the greater the chance of slip. So the engineers came up with a scheme from a fellow called John Barrackle Fell, who had invented a centre rail system which they could use to grip a centre rail with extra motors and rollers underneath to increase the grip. And they found out through trial and error that it actually wasn't needed, and it was got by wheel adhesion alone. But what they did was retain the centre rail as a braking rail. It's on the way down, so it's very, very strong caliper brakes that grip it. And as far as I am aware, it's the only railway in the world that's got a fell centre rail, so it's unique.
You go up how high from how low? You know, what's the sort of climb on this?
The railway's 4.5 miles long, and it starts off at Laxey Station, which is about 150 feet, 200 feet above sea level. Snaefell itself is 2,036 feet high, and the railway stops about 40 feet below the summit. So just a short walk from the railway station to the actual peak.
Just to describe the tram itself, I don't know how long it would be, maybe 40, 45 feet long, something like that. The interior, it's a bit like being in an old-fashioned, traditionally built boat. It's all done in oak and pine, beautiful, beautiful sort of arch ceiling here. The seats, you know, they've got bench seats with the type of backs that flip backwards and forwards.
I loved how you came on board.
Oh, just
and it kind of suddenly clicked, and it was this childish giggle as you realised that the seats were reversed. And you've also got a driver at each end.
Well, it's not a driver at each end. One's a driver and one's called a brakesman. When they get to the summit and we go back down, they'll swap ends. Technology's caught up with us to some extent. We've now got electric brakes on them, but the brakesman there is a backup so that if you need to supply the manual brakes and the centre rail, he's there as like a safety backup.
He's a pretty vital part of the team. I would argue that the driver, yeah, it's an important, but the guy on the brakes much more important.
Yeah, the driver works the brakes as well, but it's very, very much a team effort to operate the tram.
We've just passed tram number one. It's going downhill, we're going uphill. Off on our left-hand side, the land is sloping steeply away, probably for about 200-300 feet, just this rock-covered slope with a wee burn running down the bottom of it. Farmland immediately behind us in the mountain, up in that direction. Brilliant. That's us just going past the bungalow station, which means crossing the road, which is why they were ringing that bell.
What happens now, the line, after it leaves the bungalow and crosses over the mountain road, it goes in a spiral around the top of the mountain. So we're now looking south, and then you look west, northerly, and then easterly again back down the Laxey Valley, so it's like a spiral loop around the summit.
We've just got off the tram, and my goodness, it's wild.
This is a calm day. Well, it is a bit windy, isn't it?
So, we're heading up the hill.
We're going to head up the hill. We're in the shelter of the building at the moment, so we're going to have to step out of the shelter.
Okay.
It's bracing, that's what they used to say years ago.
Is it traditional to go right to the very top?
It's got to be done. You cannot come this far without going to the actual summit.
Ah, come on.
Must
then.
Do that.
Give it a go. Even on a day like today, I mean, there are flagpoles up here, you know, and the flags with the Alaman symbol on it are sort of flying straight out, stiff as boards. Yeah. It's quite a solid breeze.
I said, as far as we go on the path, now if we turn left to go up to the actual summit here.
Okay.
You can just see, appearing over the top here, the little concrete pillar which marks the summit.
You've got a trig point.
That's it.
How high did you say it was?
It's 2,036 feet high, so welcome to the summit of Snaefell.
Wow.
And we've got a great 360-degree view. Yeah. Is this a mountain indicator over here? Show you where everything is.
It shows you to get your bearings of where we are.
Okay. Right, so we are here, bang smack in the centre. Yeah. Scotland over there, straight ahead. So that's Dumfries and Galloway and the Solway Firth. Scaffold Pike across that direction. There's absolutely no chances. Look at that. Look behind you.
Nothing.
Absolutely solid.
Yeah, it's a bit misty.
And 66 miles to the mountains of Mourne.
Yeah, and 31 miles to the Mull of Galloway, which is the nearest point to the mainland. Now, what you're experiencing now is what the Manx Electric Railway and its advertising used to describe as exhilarating mountain breezes, and they used to sell it as a plus point.
I'm at the station at the bottom of the railway, so we'll probably hear the odd toot and a bit of a rattle of these delightful trams. But we're here to talk cats, specifically the Manx cat. Introduce yourself and tell me the name of your book.
My name's Sarah Goodwins. I've written a book called A Detailed Account of Manx Cats.
That's a clever, clever title.
Well, it was my husband's idea. He's the brains of the team.
And explain why it's clever.
It's clever because, of course, the Manx cat doesn't have a tail, so it's a detailed account.
Why do Manx cats not have a tail?
Well, there's lots of stories about why they don't have the tail. The real reason is that it's a genetic mutation going back to the mid-18th century. But the folklore's much more fun. The most famous one is the fact that when Noah was ushering all the animals into the ark, people on the island are quite laid back and their cats take their plenty of time. Yes, indeed. So they sauntered into the ark and Noah was getting a bit fussed because the water was rising and he shut the door a bit too quickly and cut the tail off.
And hence the Manx cat. Why is it on the island man?
It's to do with genetic inbreeding, basically. It's what they call a founder effect from the gene pool. And it just happened. We know that it happened round about the middle of the 18th century because the Manx word for cat is cat. But the Manx word for a Manx cat is stubbin, which is adopted from the English word stubby, meaning something without a tail. And you don't invent a name for something that doesn't exist. So it's round about the middle of the 18th century that this happened.
Now, normally, when a genetic malfunction occurs, it gets bred out really quickly. Why did it live on in the Isle of Man?
Because people liked it. And also, there's a lot of interest in the taillessness. It's sort of a symbol of the island, and so it became one of the things that tourists wanted to see. They wanted to see Manx cats. Unfortunately, this did happen that some people actually then cut the tails off their cats, which is a bit cruel. But the Manx cat itself was liked, and it is actually a very nice cat. It's very friendly, and it's almost dog-like because it'll go on for walks with you, and it'll talk to you, and it'll even fetch things if you want it to.
So did people want to take kittens back with them? Back to the mainland?
Yes, there was actually a breeding programme on the island as a sort of an advertising thing. It's stopped now, but there was a breeding programme on the island where Manx kittens were actually sent to famous people. That was one of the trams. The Manx kittens were actually sent to famous people, like John Wayne had one. The King had one when there were cats being pest control on ships. The Queen Mother was sent one for the Royal Yacht Britannia.
So they were moving in pretty posh circles.
Oh, indeed, of course. Well, I mean, it's always said, isn't it, a Manx cat, well, not just a Manx cat, but any cat, they don't have owners, they have staff.
But presumably people bought cats in with tails. Did they interbreed, or is there a Manx pride in having the tailless cat?
In actual fact, strictly speaking, the Manx cat isn't really a breed. You do need to have some of the genes from a tailed cat in there because it's a genetic mutation, it means that it changes the spine of the cat. And if you interbreed tailless cats too often, it can actually be very bad. Vets don't actually like it if you interbreed Manx cats too often. So when a Manx female cat has a litter, you can't actually be sure what you're going to get. Some of the cats will have no tail, some will have a short tail, and some will have a long tail.
Going back to the cats in the first place, how did the Isle of Man end up with cats?
Well, that's an interesting question. It might have been brought over by the Vikings. There's no definite thing about that. The island has a long Viking history. But the Vikings liked cats, partly as pest control. I mean, obviously, if you're living in a hut with your food in baskets around on the floor, you're going to get vermin. And so Manx cats are extremely good mousers. They're very fast and they're very agile. But the cat itself was probably brought in because Vikings actually liked to wear cat fur as decoration. So cats were partly pest controlled and partly wearing apparel.
So, because I was struggling with the idea of the Vikings having a little pussy as a little pet. It was much more practical than that.
It was, yes. You wouldn't exactly have sort of Vikings being cosy and cuddly. They did like a fight.
Did they ever get a toehold in the mainland, though, if there was all these cats being exported to famous people?
Yes, the most famous owner of the cat is probably the painter Turner, who was also the first person to have a number of Manx cats, at least the first person we know of, to have a number of Manx cats in England. And people went to visit him partly to see his paintings and partly to see his cats.
So did they go feral on the island?
Well, they have done in the past, yes. In fact, there was quite a famous feral colony in, well, it's just outside the Port Jack Chippy, but obviously listeners won't necessarily know where that is. It's along the front at Douglas. And there was quite a famous colony of Manx cats that used to hunt seabirds and actually catch them on the wing.
Wow.
Yes, yes. And a Manx cat is actually a fairly small breed of cat, so to see it tackle a seagull must have been quite interesting.
Are they good pets?
Oh, yes. Yes, they are good pets. They're very good. They're very calm. They're very placid. They like going for walks with you. They will willingly go for walks. They chat. They don't have a lot of vocal range for a cat. They tend to have a very high trill or a lowish, which sounds like a growl, but it's like a sort of a vocalised purr. But they are very nice cats indeed.
And very cruelly, you haven't got a cat.
I'm allergic to cats. They make me sneeze.
It's terrible.
I know, isn't it a shame? One thing that I have been asked, though, you know, is the tailnessness of a Manx cat, is it a fault in the Manx cat? Can it be cured? And no, it cannot be cured by retail therapy.
Sorry, I've just got that.
Oh, goodness me.
Takes me a wee while sometimes. He's not quick, but he's cheap. Now, if you're looking for the cultural, the political, maybe even the historical heart of the Isle of Man, you could do worse than go to Tynwald Hill. We met up with Andy Johnson from Manx National Heritage.
It's almost geographically in the middle of the Isle of Man. You might almost call it the belly button of the Isle of Man. And it's important because this is one of the few surviving assembly sites from the medieval period that were common throughout the Scandinavian diaspora, sites that were known as Tynwald here on the island, Tingvedla in Iceland, Dingwall in Scotland. And they are, if you like, parliaments that predate the place that likes to call itself the mother of parliaments, you know, down in London. It's a very, very significant site.
Four levels to it in complete circles, with a big white pole in the centre. It is quite a commanding position.
It is, and I think the other thing to understand is that we're in a kind of natural amphitheatre. We're surrounded by hills on most sides, and if you were to sweep away the trees that surround this lovely sort of modern arboretum and the village of St John's that lies just to the south, and you looked at it from the perspective of, say, even up to the 19th century, but then right the way back into the mists of medieval times, you'd have seen something very different, quite a prominent plateau rising up from the valley floor.
There's quite a lot of basically tiered seating off to our left-hand side here to the north of this site. There's this long avenue. I mean, that's beautiful, Imone. It's like a cricket pitch across there. What happens here?
On our national day, July the 5th, we have an annual open-air assembly, and what this does is it commemorates the way of assembling from medieval times onwards. And it's a time when our parliament, Tynwald, meets in the open, in public, but in a way that you can't achieve with the modern legislative chamber. You know, everybody comes here. There are thousands and thousands of people who come to watch. And the grandstand you just mentioned, that's there for important guests and homecomers. Sometimes people who, because of their Manx surnames, travel back to the mother country from the other side of the world in many cases.
How did it work? Because we've got these concentric circles. Was it the hierarchy at the top and the troops at the bottom?
Pretty much. What you see now is a landscape in the immediate vicinity which has come together really from the mid-19th century onwards. Our British Victorian leaders somewhat transformed the place from what was here before. The elements that you had were the hill itself, which as far as we know has stood like this in this strange tiered arrangement for centuries, and at the other end of a processional way there's a chapel, and it really marks the kind of coming together of church and state to govern the people. And what happens is that people progress from the chapel to the mound, and there they are seated, each according to their sort of degree and importance. And we have good documentary sources from the very beginning of the 15th century that explain how that was all arranged. And we see an echo of that right the way down to the present day.
What about the hill itself? What was that made from?
That's a really interesting question, and we get into a kind of mixture of archaeological conservatism and flights of folkloric fantasy.
Give me the fantasy.
We like that right. Stuff. Yeah.
The fantasy, right. Yeah. The fantasy is that the hill is made from soil from each of the 17 medieval parishes.
I don't know how you could see the logic of that, though. If you're bringing people from the four corners of the island, you know, they did it at the Scottish Parliament. They brought stone from all over the country to build a wall. It's a thing you probably would do.
certainly there's vast symbolism with that kind of story or explanation. I tend to take, as I say, a little bit more of a conservative view. We are actually pretty close to the border of two of the really most important parishes on this part of the west coast of the island, and I suspect that all it would take is a requirement to bring a cartload of soil to make a small repair from literally just 150 metres over the border just to the south, and you're in a different parish. And that's all it takes for the genesis of that kind of story.
When the Parliament convenes here on the 5th of July, does it actually do anything, or is it just for show? Is there any other purpose to it? Do they actually legislate?
They legislate in as much as they have what we call the promulgation of the laws. And what that means today is that the laws that have been passed in the previous 12 months, the titles of those laws are read out in English and Manx, the idea being that by doing it that way, everybody would understand what was involved. Those are read out traditionally by our two senior judges, our deemsters, and by doing that, it is deemed that those laws are now, as it were, in law.
What a great idea. You are, to trade, an archaeologist. What is the Isle of Man like in terms of archaeology? Because I must confess, even flying into the airport, I've never been to this island before, I was spotting stuff lying on the ground thinking, oh, that's interesting.
It's an incredibly rich historical landscape. We have monuments going back to the Neolithic period, but we also have tiny fragments, artifacts, that kind of thing, going all the way back to the Mesolithic. So actually, much like you, we have good archaeological evidence for occupation 10,000 years ago. We actually have 10,000-year-old buildings now discovered actually under the flight path of the airport you've just flown in on.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith, and this week we're in the Isle of Man. This place has really taken me by surprise. I've never been to the island before. It's not big, it's only about 35 miles long, but it is packed with interest. Scenically, it's very attractive. Some nice cliffs, really pretty beaches, lovely wee fishing villages and things, roads twisting right up through the hills, fantastic views. And it's also got very distinctive flora and fauna. Tricia Sale is from the Manx Wildlife Trust.
Hello and welcome to Close Sartfield Nature Reserve.
It's a really, really beautiful wildflower meadow.
It's a gorgeous meadow, yes, one of six that we have on this site.
Never terribly moved about a meadow, but you'd be hard not to be impressed with this. Carpets of loads of different kind of grasses and lots of colour as well. And you're going to take us through some of them. What have we got here?
This is Eyebright. It's a little white flower, quite low growing. It's a semi-parasitic plant, so it parasitizes grasses.
How does it do that?
It feeds into the roots of the grasses, feeds off it. You find it in treatments for the eyes, sort of homeopathic type things. And I've read the Victorian ladies used to make it into a sort of a...
like a tincture or
something. Yeah, that sort of thing, and put it in their eyes, makes pupils dilate. So shows that you're attracted to whoever you're talking to.
You've got lots of orchids here.
Yeah, on the site we've got six species in total. The majority of what you see are the common spotted and the heath spotted orchids and the hybrids that they have. We also have northern marsh, early marsh, both in quite small quantities. Greater butterfly orchid in very tiny quantities, i.e. one this year so far, and tway blade orchid.
And the yellow ones as well, what are they?
The yellow flowers, that's lesser trefoil, one of the many legumes.
Well, this little stuff down here?
That little one there, yes.
Yeah. Different types of grasses too. People don't tend to look at grasses, but grasses can be really beautiful.
They're very attractive plants, I think. Yeah, there's probably half a dozen or so species here. The one you've got there's Yorkshire Fog.
It's that beautiful. When you get close up to it, it's got that lovely iridescent purple quality.
It has, yes.
And you get that, you know, it's slightly overcast today, but on a sunny day, you get a whole shimmering effect of the purple and the flowers as well. It's a
This one here is sweet vernal grass. That's the one that gives hay its very distinctive smell.
It wasn't always a meadow.
No, up until the early 1980s, most of the site was farmed. A local farmer grew a crop of potatoes, harvested them, put it back to grass, put cattle out on it for a few years, and then went through the same rotation. So it wasn't intensive by any means. But in the early 80s, he gave up farming. The trust didn't acquire the land until about 1987, and just in that short time, lots of scrub trees had spread in. Mm-hmm. So the trust's objective was to clear any scattered scrub and try and get back to wildflower meadows by late cutting for hay and then grazing over the winter with sheep.
You've cleared the gorse, you've cleared the scrub. How do you create the meadow?
The main process that we've always adopted on this site and others is that we remove the vegetation by some means, be that cutting or grazing or a combination. The idea is to reduce the nutrients because, generally speaking, up to a point obviously, the lower the nutrients, the greater the diversity. So you take away all the accumulated vegetation. In this instance, because it hadn't been cultivated in any way for 3 or 4 years, there was quite a build-up of thatch, dead material. So cut that and remove it. The aftergrass is then grazed and you just go into the same process. But compared with a farmer, we cut our hay really late.
But how do you go about getting that variety of wildflower meadow that presumably not all the plants were latent?
Well, at this stage, obviously seed will be coming in various forms. Seed will get blown in. We might have brought seed in on our feet today. Seed can remain dormant for a very long time. I mean, they reckon that orchid seed can remain dormant for up to 100 years. And if you just create the right conditions, that enables them to come through. Generally speaking, when you put on fertiliser or farmyard manure, it tends to encourage the grasses. So you'll get a much taller, denser crop of grass, which effectively just cuts out the light and warmth for the variety of wildflowers. And because we cut our hay late, many of the plants have had a chance to flower and set seed before it's then cut. So when it's cut and turned for baling, drops the seed and that's next year's crop of wildflowers. If we didn't do any management, it would very quickly become currock, i.e. willow scrub. That then kind of continues on and eventually you get woodland. So the whole thing is succession. And what we're doing is suspending that stage at the wildflower meadow.
Just surrounding this meadow, there is low-growing willow, some big willow. There is elder. I've seen hawthorn and ivy and all sorts of things round about here. We're here mid-afternoon. It's an overcast, slightly grey day. On a summer's evening, I would anticipate this to be absolutely alive with something like swallows.
Yes, even during the day it can be good with swallows. And on a sunny day, when you stood in the meadow, providing you can't hear anything else, then all you can hear is the hum of bees and hoverflies.
That's unusual nowadays. We're standing on the beachfront at Douglas on the Isle of Man, and Peter Kelly is a local historian. The name Douglas sounds terribly Scottish to me. How did it get its name?
Ah, well, it's Douglas, and it's two rivers, the River Dou, which is the Black River, and the River Glass, which is the White River, and they converge just a mile from where we're standing, and then the little fishing village where the two rivers came together was called Douglas.
We're standing in a bay, and behind the beach there is a road, and behind the road there is a lineup of hotels and casinos and everything else that frankly wouldn't embarrass Torquay. How did this come to be?
Right. Well, first of all, you've got to go back. 1830 was the big changing date for the Isle of Man, and for two reasons. One, the establishment of a railway from Manchester to Liverpool in 1830, and secondly, the establishment of a steamboat from Liverpool to the Isle of Man in the same year. So from 1830, people could get from Manchester to to Liverpool and from Liverpool to the Isle of Man in the same day.
So did it really take off? Because looking around the bay, this wonderful Victorian architecture that is very, very similar. There's not a huge variation apart from a monstrosity from the 60s that they must have had to knock down some beautiful buildings to produce. But they're all of a similar nature.
No, right. Well, 1840s is when this part of what's now Douglas Promenade was laid out. It was all the grounds of the Castle Mona Hotel, or the Castle Mona as it was, owned by the Duke of Athol from Blair Athol.
Oh, yes.
And this was his summer residence. So he owned
shooting
the
in Scotland in the winter and Ironman in the summer.
Bucket spades and rock. But no, he lived there, but from 1830, all the land was sold off gradually. So if we just look behind us, you'll see sort of Regency buildings.
Yeah.
Well, they date from 1842. As tourism took off, then what was happening with what were originally private houses, they extended at the rear so they could add another 10 bedrooms or whatever, and they started to take in guests. And then the big change came in 1874, and looking further round to the left, all those high Victorian buildings, when I say high yeah. architecture,
yeah.
they came from 1876 onwards. And that's really when things took off with a bang.
I'm going to ask a really vulgar question. Where did the money come from? Because you drive about this island, there are some big, posh buildings. It indicates money to me.
Right.
Was it all tourism?
Right. Well, going back to the 1870s, the buildings there, the vast majority of people who ran them were from Lancashire. They were investors from Manchester, in particular, Lancaster, the big Grand Hotel complex, which was a hotel, music hall, theatre, swimming baths, bowling alley, 1876 bowling alley, and a temperance hall, all in one thing. They were Manchester investors.
Uh-huh.
They lost out.
They invested all the money and lost their pants.
The trouble was, you see, with a lot of these companies, they set their capital and then they end up spending all the capital on the development, and then there is nothing, and there's no return.
Nothing left.
So this is where Mr. Lightfoot, a canny Yorkshire man, came along. He's the one who gave Douglas his horse trams. He bought that complex and finished it off. In fact, the theatre, he was so pleased with it, that opened in 1882, that 4 years later, he pulled the back of it down and made it three times as big. He made money out of it. The initial investors didn't.
It's also got strong connections with the RNLI.
Yeah. Well, again, turning around behind us, you can just see the sunlight's on it, a thing called the Tower of Refuge.
Which one's that?
That's that little
castle
building, immediately under the lighthouse from where we're standing.
Okay.
Now, that's on a rock. It was called St. Mary's Rock. And the harbour, none of those piers that you see from here existed. There was a short pier further inland. So when shipping was coming across at high tide, they couldn't see this rock, which was close to the surface, and they would founder. And living in a property which had now been demolished was Sir William Hillary, and he witnessed several ships founder, usually in bad and stormy weather, because they had no control, you know, and God, were ending up on the rocks. And he got together local fishermen, sailors, created a lifeboat, and he couldn't swim, but he was there on the end steering the damn thing to get out to rescue people. Well, then he came up with the idea, look, this rock is a nuisance. So John Welsh, an architect who he engaged, designed this little castle to sit on top of it. So when the tide is high, the castle is standing above the waves.
Mm-hmm.
So sailors are wise enough to think, well, it's not on stilts. Avoid the castle. But it was called the Tower Refuge because if, for some reason, you did end up grounding on it, you had somewhere to get out of your sinking ship and climb up to the battlements and wait.
Was it a genteel destination?
Initially, yes. In fact, the Duke of Athol, before he sold out in 1826, he built... You can just see them over there to our right. They're sort of ground and first floor buildings. He built those to let to genteel families for the summer. So they would come, they would bring a servant, the family, the parrot, the dogs, and they would lease a whole house, probably from April through to October. But you see, being a developing tourist destination in Victorian and Edwardian times, equally this was happening at Blackpool, Morecambe, Southport, but the advantage that the Isle of Man had was the sea journey. Mm-hmm. And the advertising would
sense
say,
of adventure.
Come abroad to the Isle of Man. And this was the difference, you know. And, of course, when you got here, you got the bracing sea air, you had all the glare. I mean, Blackpool was, you know, just on the promenade, that was it. Here you could go on electric tram, steel railway, you could visit various glens, places of entertainment, Laxey, there was a big pavilion, and so on. So there was so much more here. Everybody who had a piece of land that was close to where the tourists would go cashed in. It was a circle, it was going round and round, everything got bigger and bigger and bigger. And that was the same with people coming on the boats and the steam packet. The more people that came, the bigger the next ship. And the bigger the next ship, more people again. So the next ship was bigger still, and so it went on. We were on a great cycle going in the right direction.
Historian Peter Kelly there, standing on the beach in the setting sun in Douglas. Now, you can't come to the Isle of Man without mentioning the famous TT, or Tourist Trophy Races. The races started out in 1907 and continue to this day. We've had to time our arrival in the Isle of Man in such a way that it was after the TT races, because otherwise we simply wouldn't have got a bed for the night. The place is packed out for the entire duration. I was quite keen to see round the course. Aye, not driving a motorbike, that would have been daft in my case. Well, it's a motorbike of sorts. It's a motorbike trike, and even then we weren't allowed to take the controls. Dave Cubbin of Isle of Man Trike Tours was the man in charge.
This is us up and moving forward already. We're only doing about 30 miles an hour or something like that.
Yeah, and it's beginning to feel slightly more than 30. I imagine it might well pick up a bit. Not the ideal weather conditions for this. There's a lot of mist and rain up in the tops there, so we're not going to go and do the full TT, but we're certainly going to get the experience.
Basically, we're hurtling down a back, well, not hurtling, I mean, basically, we're doing about 40 miles an hour, but it feels like hurtling, down a back road out in the country. Hedgerows on either side of us. A patchwork of fields is actually remarkably like Ireland. You know, the wee shapes, wee odd shapes of fields. Earlier, we passed along the coast road, and you're looking straight down from about 150, 200 feet above the sea. This is a fabulous way of seeing the Isle of Man. It's really good fun.
It's an extraordinary experience, that. It's a bit like being sat on the roof of a saloon car and driven about.
Yeah, you're sat sort of a couple of foot higher than me when I'm driving. You are exposed to all the elements, sort of thing, but it gives you a better sort of view. You're not trying to look having to look over the back of my head like you would be on if you were pillion on a motorbike. It sort of gives you a clear range of view as well.
The TT, how big a deal is it?
To be honest, the best way to describe it is to say that the Isle of Man really does come alive for a fortnight. I think I'm right in saying that there was somewhere in the region of 40,000 visitors, I think, potentially, most years.
Well, that used to be a nightmare, even logistically, getting all the bikes here.
Yeah, I mean, the steam packet run extra sailings and things. The dynamics of it change slightly, because when I was younger growing up, there was obviously more guest houses and things on the front, so you had a sea of bikes on the seafront in Douglas. But now, with things moving more towards outer town and campsites and things, it almost looks like there's less bikes over, because they're not as concentrated. But what it is, they're actually spread further out. But it's a brilliant atmosphere.
The course itself's about 37 miles.
37 and three quarter miles, yeah.
How fast do they go around it?
The current lap record was set by Peter Hickman in last year's senior race, and that was an average speed of 135.5 miles an hour.
I wish people could see your face.
Put in some kind of context, you know, this isn't a racetrack.
No,
these are normal twisty, turny roads. There's occasional straight bits.
Yep, every other day of the year they're public roads. Kurt Michael, for instance, is a village out on the west coast of the island. People's front doors open directly out onto the pavement, and you'll see people actually stood in their doorway watching the bikes come past.
We've been driving around, and obviously it finished last week. They've still got phone boxes, pillar boxes, telegraph poles, everything. They're all wrapped at certain locations with what look like big mattresses.
Yeah, obviously things have progressed in terms of safety. You've moved from what was hay bales strapped to, as you say, telephone boxes and lampposts and things in the end, the sort of stub ends of walls, to having the more advanced protection barriers that they have now. Yeah. And they're brought out before TT every year and then brought back in at the end of the TT.
Would you do it?
No.
I was going to walk back to Douglas if he said yes.
I would love to, but I would run out of talent and then very soon after road.
Yeah.
The concentration must be phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine what the riders actually put themselves through. I mean, you talk about the concentration side of it, but even the physical side of having to wrestle, especially the 1,000cc bikes, having to wrestle them round the circuit for six laps, it's absolutely immense.
Mm-hmm. You were telling me something about the boots that they wear.
Yeah, because obviously when they're throwing their body weight from side to side on the machine to change direction on the bike, they can actually wear through the soles on their boots with the efforts they're putting in. And a lot of them, you'll see, sort of they have their hands taped to stop their hands blistering with all the efforts and forces through the bar and the on off on the throttle sort of things.
You can't control it. Suddenly a pheasant comes out in front
of
you.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the risks of it, isn't it? There's no margin for error, really, with it. As you've seen yourselves driving around, it's stone walls, hedges and lampposts and gateposts.
This is the point where we're going to go for a blast up the hill.
Yeah, this is why we're wearing plastic trousers here at the moment.
Visor down.
Yeah.
That's it. It's going to flip down anyway. This is the long straight up towards Kate's cottage. I like it. We're up to 70 miles an hour now. Listen, it's a bit like being perched on the roof of a car. It's great fun. Wow. Basically, we're up in moorland at the moment. Sheep on the hills below us, patchworks of fields. And if we could go right to the very top of the hill, we'd be in cloud. But this is such a blast. This is us heading back down towards the pub now.
Yeah, there was a danger we couldn't go out today because the forecast is terrible and the roads are a bit damp, but really glad we got out. It's brilliant.
I'm absolutely delighted we managed to get out. There we go. Pulling in front of the pub.
Wow.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. We were doing about, at one stage there, about 80, 85 miles an hour, which is about half the speed they're doing. I have no idea how they can actually absorb the visual information.
No, it is absolutely crackers. But I mean, Joey Dunlop, who's the most successful TT rider of all time, they asked him how he managed to go around as fast as he did. And he was quoted as having said, well, there's a grey blur and a green blur. I stay on the grey one.
You can see what he's coming
for. Pretty accurate, to be fair.
And, you know, I was watching the speedo, and I was actually watching in kilometres. Oh!
We're so delighted we managed to get out on this. It's great. Great that we managed to dry up, but thank you very much again.
It's great to have you. Unfortunately, we are at the mercy of the weather a lot of the time. We don't like disappointing people and letting them down. We'll always do what we can.
80 mile an hour was fine. Yeah, just about did.
Hi, my name is Sandrina Tees. I am the business owner at the famous Craigner Bar in the Isle of Man.
This is on the route of the TT. How mad does it get?
It's hard to put in words exactly how mad it gets. We try to explain to people who've never been the numbers and numbers of bikers, visitors here for the TT. It's just crazy, crazy, crazy.
And this is allegedly one of the best spots to view it from.
Apparently so, yes. From the Craig, you actually get the most viewing. You know, you actually see them coming down from Kate, and then you can see them going off on down to Hillbury. So it's not just a quick zoom right past. Yeah. It's a lot of viewing time up at the Craig.
Do you not feel a bit of a target? Because we've got the market. I've just come down on the back of a trike down this big long straight. And yeah, we were only doing 85 or whatever. It felt like a lot to me, but these guys are doing double that speed. That must be quite nerve-wracking watching.
It is, but they do obviously have to slow to get round this corner.
Not much, but you do.
So they do have that, and it's actually great to see them, you know, with their knee down going round this corner, especially from the balconies and the grandstands. It's fantastic.
Do you actually get to watch it?
No. No, I literally get I get a little glimpse now and again through the windows or whatever, but not much at all, no. Just last year, we got the licence to actually marry somebody at the front of the pub where we're stood right now. It was fantastic. They were marshals, had marshalled for many, many years, and they turned up in their orange jackets as well, which was absolutely fantastic.
The bride wore orange.
Yes, absolutely. So, which is great, you know, memories for them and memories for us as well.
And it must be more or less a 24-hour exercise while the TT is on for you, you know, as a hotel and a pub, catering, getting the amount of drink that you need, all that type of stuff.
Yes, it is. The logistics it's hard, you know, really, really hard. You're thinking on your feet all the time. With this year, there were so many delays, cancellations and everything, and you're trying to juggle, and you feel for the bikers, you feel for them, that's what they're here for. And we're trying to say, well, should we open earlier tomorrow and, you know, go in line with the race programme every day?
I'm not going to ask you for figures, but it must be a huge injection of cash into anybody's business.
Yeah, anybody's business on the Isle of Man. I wouldn't say rely. We have a really, really good year-through business. But in general, the TT is what boosts every business on the Isle of Man, I would say.
So what's it like? Here we are a week later. Do you just feel sigh of relief if they regroup or say, well, come back?
No, Father's Day's on Sunday and the phone won't stop ringing.
Go away, the TT's just finished.
Yeah.
Well, my name's John Collister. Everybody knows me as Dog, John Dog. I got that at school. I was PC Bulldog on a school play and it stuck. In fact, for a long time I was PC Bulldog.
So where are we going?
We're going out into it's an area called Balaf Curragh. Curragh is a Gaelic word. It's the same word as curra, without the k on the end in Irish, where they do a lot of horse training, but it's called Curragh over here.
I should just explain, in case somebody's wondering what the sort of clattering and banging is. Human life at its best is all about variety. We are now in your works van, which is full of tools in the back.
Full of tools.
You know, so you're a carpenter to trade, but you are also a poet and a former bard of the Isle of Man.
I was the third bard. Yeah, very, very honoured to have been bard of the Isle of Man.
How did you get to become a bard?
Well, I've written poetry since the 60s, late 60s, and I was a bit of a closet poet. I had all sorts of stuff and song lyrics. That's what I was hoping to make my fortune at. More recently, a lady decided to have a bard of the Isle of Man. So I didn't know about this, but the very first bard was a very, very famous, from our point of view, Manx poet called T.E. Brown. And he wrote wonderful, wonderful stuff. And he was posthumously the first bard, and then they chose a second bard, and that's when I started to hear about this thing. So when the third bard come up, I had to submit, I think, two or three, four poems to them and go up and read them and be interviewed, and then you know, they said, you've won, to coin a phrase. So I was a bard for a year. I had to wear an outfit, like a cloak, a coat, and a hat, and carry a staff. So I've had a great time, and they're now up to, I think, the seventh, maybe sixth or seventh bard.
What do they look for? I mean, what do they look for in a Manx bard? I mean, do you have to be born here? Is it your poetry concern? No. The Isle of Man?
No, you don't have to be born here. You have to live here. I am Manx born and bred, and a lot of my poetry is in dialect. My accent, for want of a better word.
So is that in dialect, or is that in Gaelic or Gaelic?
I've written some that have been translated into Manx Gaelic.
Well, we just got out of the van, and I'm a classic leaning up against a fence post. And you tell me what you're seeing.
It's a good wildflower meadow. Two meadows across is one of has been classified as one of the best in the world.
Yeah. Does a scene like this inspire you to write poetry?
Yes, yes. This place in particular, but I'm very critical, and I haven't yet written a poem about this field or about this area that I'm happy with.
You're well established on the island for a couple of really big belters. I mean, give us a big hitter.
Well, the one I'm always asked to say is about there's a boat in the morning, and that expression comes from people come over here and they do nothing but moaning about there's nothing to do, or there's this, that and the other. So we have a Manx expression, there's a boat in the morning if you don't like it. So this was one I wrote. I wrote it in the car driving back from Douglas. I stopped two or three times to write it, and I had three verses, and I went to a meal one day, and I read the three verses, and then somebody said, well, what about this, that and the other? So I eventually added a fourth verse, which is the pièce de résistance. So it's called There's a Boat in the Morning. If you think the roads are too bumpy and the horse trams are really a pain, and you don't like the cowl in the winter and we're getting far too much rain, in the summer you can't go out shopping, you're blocked in because of the bikes, remember, there's a boat in the morning if things are not how you like. The place is full of them foreigners, they're coming in droves every day. And that many cars on the road there for parking you now have to pay. There's queues wherever you're going, like going to look at the show. Remember, there's a boat in the morning, and you'll not be missed if you go. The beer in the pubs isn't suiting. House prices are way out of sight. The cost of your fuel, Ellis Killen, and there's nothing to do every night. To eat out here costs a fortune. Class acts coming over are rare. Remember, there's a boat in the morning, and I'll even give you your fare. Now, they call the packet boat the ferry. Cross the Mersey is where ferries go. The Ben and Manannan come to Douglas and regular ply to and fro. Well, maybe not quite so regular. I know you may think this is jest. Remember, there may be a boat in the morning, so turn up and hope for the best.
I don't think there's anybody in an island anywhere who doesn't understand our sentiments.
Big chunks of Scotland, Orkney and Shetland.
Well, the
Western Isles, everything.
Yeah, the boat used to sail no matter what. You know, it could be force 10, it would go.
It's interesting because you're talking about the Gaelic and the Gaelic down here and your dialect and things. I listen to you and I hear Scouse.
Well, that's the nearest, probably. Mm. And my mum is a Scouser, but that hasn't had any influence on my accent. Our accent, particularly Douglas, is there's a lot of Scouse influence. You see, we're in between Northern Ireland and Liverpool, and there's a lot of people say there's a bit of Northern Ireland in there too.
Yeah.
So I've got, as I say, what's considered quite good, strong Manx accent, but it is definitely Scouse for people like yourself who probably never heard a Manx accent before.
What about the Gaelic? How much is that used?
I use a lot of Gaelic words, like trying to think of something. If somebody makes a mistake or something, you say you made a brock of that. Brock means a mess.
Well, we would say a burach.
Well, that's close, isn't it?
Yeah, very close.
Yeah. We use it like cowl. We don't say cold. Cowl. You know, it's cowl.
See, cowl.
Yeah. We're in a hayfield now. When the cornfield just starts to come up through, you would hear people say, oh, look at the bruit. And the bruit is when it just starts to show green. Kiddig. I've got a bit of left-handedness in me, and I've got left-handed children. Kiddig is a left-hander.
Are there still native speakers?
Oh, aye. There's a school at St John's that's been going probably 20 years maybe, I might be wrong, but 20 years, the children are taught everything through the medium of Manx Gaelic. And these children are now to the point where they're having children who will again go, so the whole family is bilingual.
Given the fact that this is such a popular island, lots of people are retiring here, people come, you know, there's lots of tourism, TT races, everything else. How is this place able to hang on to its identity? Because it does have a very clearly defined identity.
I think people are proud of what we've got. I know I'm very proud. I talk to people and I'm always singing praises of the Isle of Man. And the bulk of the people come here because of what we've got. Yeah. And you get non-Manx people coming here to live and they appreciate what we've got. And they're some of the people who are most fervently Manx, once they've been here a while, and they're the ones who'll fight for the Manx, and some of the Manx are too slack to bother. And a lot of Manx people, you hear them say, oh, you know, what are we worrying about, you know that. So, but the incomers realise they've left somewhere that they weren't very happy with, they've found something that they are, and they don't want it to change.
You're still writing as much poetry?
Yeah, but as the mood takes me, I'll get an idea.
Well, listen, John, thank you very much for the poetry. That was a real delight. Thank you. I said at one stage on this trip that I arrived on the Isle of Man in a state of almost total grace. I was completely innocent of it. I knew nothing about it. It's been a revelation to me. And we started off under the sea cliff, and I thought we should finish underneath the sea cliff.
Because this amazing
sound's just extraordinary.
There's an absolute wall, I don't know, 120-foot cliff, just packed full of seabirds. It's incredible.
Yeah.
We are just below a whole nest site of razorbills and guillemots and fulmars, and you can hear the kittiwakes every so often. It's been an absolute delight being here on the Isle of Man. We're just going to leave you with a sound from all of the team at BBC Aberdeen on the Isle of Man. Thanks for listening.